From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Like every CEO of a major organization, I am responsible for what happens at the Department of Justice. I acknowledge that mistakes were made here. I accept that responsibility.
Alberto Gonzalez, the Attorney General, on the firing of 8 U.S. attorneys last year. He insists he won't resign, but in Congress, calls are growing for him to step down.
His time in office should be over.
We'll hear testimony from one of the fired attorneys in a Senate hearing, and we'll speak with journalist and author Joe Connison. Then 2 years after U.S. forces shot to death Italian intelligence agent Nicola Calipari in Iraq, Washington's refusing to hand over the U.S. soldier charged in the case to be tried in Italy. Calipari was killed while escorting Italian journalist Giuliana Sgrena after securing her release from a month-long abduction in Iraq. Giuliana Sgrena will join us in our Firehouse studio. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez has acknowledged mistakes in the firing of 8 U.S. attorneys, but is refusing calls to stand down. This comes as the House Judiciary Committee has released a series of emails and documents showing the White House initiated the process more than 2 years ago that led to the dismissals. The decisions were made in part on whether the prosecutors, quote, exhibited loyalty to the president and attorney general. On Capitol Hill, Democratic lawmakers say they want to question White House advisor Karl Rove and former White House counsel Harriet Myers. More on the attorney controversy after headlines. We'll speak with Joe Connison. Meanwhile, two Democratic Congress members are asking Congress to investigate another attorney dismissal, this one 5 years ago. Congress members George Miller of California and Nick Rahal of West Virginia want to look into the firing of Frederick Black on the island of Guam. Black had begun investigating the activities of the now-convicted Republican lobbyist Jack Abramoff at the time. The probe ended shortly after Black was let go. In Mexico, a protest outside the U.S. Embassy against President Bush's visit grew violent Tuesday as demonstrators clashed with police. Police used tear gas to disperse hundreds of people. The scuffles came hours after President Bush promised to reform U.S. immigration laws.
The United States respects rule of law. But in the debate on migration, I remind my fellow citizens that family values do not stop at the Rio Grande River, that there are decent, hardworking, honorable citizens of Mexico who want to make a living for their families.
Protests continued to follow President Bush throughout his visit to Mexico. Earlier Tuesday, hundreds turned out in the city of Mérida. This is Gerardo Hernandez, a spokesperson for the opposition Democratic Revolution Party.
This carpet is for the Bush-Calderon meeting so that when Calderon kneels before Bush, his knees will not get hurt because here the floor is made of sharp stones.
Mexico is the last stop of President Bush's Latin American tour. He returns to the U.S. today. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has reportedly told aides he fears the Bush administration will force him out if the Iraqi parliament fails to pass a draft oil law by the end of June. The Associated Press reports the U.S. has told Maliki he should have a coalition government in place that would be acceptable to the main Sunni U.S. allies, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Egypt. The U.S. military is expanding two major prisons in Iraq ahead of an expected rise in Iraqi prisoners from the new crackdown in Baghdad. Thousands of prisoners are expected on top of the 17,000 already behind bars. The U.S. is being accused of bringing its practice of secretly transferring prisoners to East Africa. Human rights advocates in Kenya say the Bush administration has engineered the secret transfers of more than 150 people captured during the recent conflict in Somalia. The prisoners are said to include children as young as 7 months old. They were held in Kenya before being transferred to secret locations in Somalia and Ethiopia. The McClatchy News Service says the State Department declined to respond to questions over its involvement. In Zimbabwe, opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai has been hospitalized in intensive care as he recovers from a beating at the hands of police. Tsvangirai and dozens of his supporters were detained Sunday as riot police stopped a planned mass protest. Attorneys say he may have suffered a skull fracture and internal bleeding. Earlier Tuesday, Tsvangirai appeared in court for the first time. Accompanied by opposition Senator Arthur Mutambara, he was asked about his condition following the beating.
Oh, terrible. Terrible.
It was a horrible assault.
Well, it was a violent, sadist attack on defenseless people.
Yeah, I'm going to go.
Okay, all right.
We don't recognize this illegitimate regime of Robert Mugabe. We're going to continue to defy them. We don't recognize Posa. We don't recognize Robert Mugabe. They're criminals.
The Sudanese government has rejected a UN Human Rights Council report accusing it of orchestrating and taking part in international crimes in Darfur. More than 200,000 people have been killed, at least 2 million driven from their homes over the past 4 years. On Tuesday, Sudan said the report's invalid and that the humanitarian situation in Darfur has improved. Meanwhile, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Louise Arbour called for more international pressure on Sudan.
First step is to not to suppress the truth, to ensure that the public is properly informed, accurately informed of what is happening on the ground, and that governments collectively put to the government of Sudan their expectations that what is happening in Darfur will stop, that the targeting of civilians will stop.
Britain has become the first country to unveil legislation that would set binding limits on emissions of greenhouse gas. The proposal calls for a reduction of 60% by the year 2050. British Prime Minister Tony Blair said the targets would set the stage for a continent-wide standard in Europe.
Part of our approach is to set a series of tasks for ourselves as a country here nationally, but then secondly, to make sure we tackle climate change at a European level, and last week's agreement at the European Council was again an epoch-making agreement. It's the first time a group of nations has come together and agreed such ambitious targets for the emission, for the reduction in the emissions of greenhouse gases.
Several environmental groups say the legislation should go further. The British group Christian Aid is calling for a targeted reduction of 80%. Back in the United States, a controversial case of high-flying profiling is now headed to court. Six Muslim leaders removed from a U.S. Airways flight last year have filed suit against the airline for discrimination. The imams were on their way back from an imam conference in Minneapolis. They were led off the plane in handcuffs and questioned for several hours after they were seen praying together before boarding the plane. U.S. Airways denied them passage on any of its other flights and refused to help them obtain tickets through another airline. The airline has refused to apologize. One of the nation's largest evangelical groups has come out against the Bush administration on the treatment of detainees in the so-called war on terror. The National Association of Evangelicals has endorsed a statement saying the administration's policies have crossed, quote, boundaries of what's legally and morally permissible. The declaration continues, tragically, documented cases of torture and inhumane and cruel behavior have occurred at various sites in the war on terror, and current law opens procedural loopholes for more to continue. The National Association of Evangelicals represents nearly 45,000 churches in the United States. In military news, new figures show the number of openly gay and lesbian service members discharged from the military under Don't Ask, Don't Tell dropped sharply last year. Critics say the figures show the Pentagon's abandoning the policy, not because it's discriminatory, but because of the need for more troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. Around 600 gay and lesbian troops were dismissed last year, fewer than half the number let go in 2001. Service members' Legal Defense Network spokesperson Steve Rawls said, quote, it's hypocritical that the Pentagon seems to retain gay and lesbian service members when they need them most and fires them when it believes they're expendable. The news comes as General Peter Pace, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, has refused to apologize for calling homosexuality immoral. Pace says he regrets making the comments but stands by his beliefs. The state of Georgia has stopped enrolling new children in its child health insurance program over a more than $100 million shortfall in federal funding. On Tuesday, legislators said they've reached a temporary agreement that would keep currently enrolled children in the program, but warn their services could run out when funds dry up at the end of the month. Georgia is one of 14 states facing child insurance shortfalls. Here in New York, one of the four police officers involved in the fatal shooting of Amadou Diallo has filed suit against the New York Police Department to return him to active duty. Kenneth Boss says he's been effectively blocked since his acquittal and has time served as a Marine in the Iraq War. Boss and three other officers were cleared in Diallo's killing 8 years ago. The unarmed Diallo was shot 41 times. And finally, a grand jury in Queens could decide today on whether to indict any of the police officers involved in the shooting of an unarmed African-American, Sean Bell. Bell was killed the morning of his wedding day. New York Police Commissioner Raymond Kelly says 1,700 police officers are on standby to deal with any unrest following the grand jury's decision. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Calls for Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez to resign are increasing as more details emerge on how the Justice Department worked with the White House to fire eight U.S. attorneys. Gonzalez acknowledged Tuesday mistakes have been made but refused to step down. On Capitol Hill, Democratic lawmakers said they want to question White House advisor Karl Rove and former White House counsel Harriet Myers. The House Judiciary Committee released a series of emails and documents that show the White House initiated the process more than 2 years ago that led to the dismissals. The decisions were made in part on whether the prosecutors, quote, exhibited loyalty to the president and attorney general. In one case, the attorney general's chief of staff, D. Kyle Sampson, who resigned Monday, urged the White House counsel's office to call him regarding, quote, the real problem we have right now with Carol Lam. Carol Lam was the U.S. attorney in Southern California who was leading the investigation of former Republican Congressmember Randy Duke Cunningham, who went to jail. Sampson's email came on May 11, 2006, the same day the Los Angeles Times reported Lam's investigation was expanding to include another California Republican, Congressmember Jerry Lewis. Carol Lam later became one of the eight prosecutors fired. In a few minutes, we'll speak with journalist Joe Connison. He's been following the story closely. But first, we turn to the testimony of David Iglesias. He was dismissed as U.S. attorney in New Mexico. He testified before the Senate last week. He was questioned by Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer.
I was at home. This was the only time I'd ever received a call from any member of Congress while at home during my tenure as United States Attorney for New Mexico. Mr. Bell called me. I was in my bedroom. My wife was nearby, and he indicated that the senator wanted to speak with me. He indicated that there were some complaints by some citizens. So I said, okay. And he says, here's the senator. So he handed the phone over, and I recognized the voice as being Senator Pete Domenici. And he wanted to ask me about the corruption matters or the corruption cases that had been widely reported in the local media. I said, all right. And he said, are these going to be filed before November? And I said, I didn't think so. And to which he replied, I'm very sorry to hear that. And then the line went dead.
So in other words, he hung up on you.
That's how I took that, yes, sir.
And he didn't say goodbye or anything
like
that. Now, did you take that as a sign of his unhappiness with your decision?
I felt sick afterward. So I felt he was upset that at hearing the answer that he received.
Right. And so is it fair to say that you felt pressured to hurry subsequent cases and prosecutions as a result of the call?
Yes, sir, I did. I felt leaned on. I felt pressured to get these matters moving.
Mm-hmm. And as you say, it was unusual for you to receive a call from a senator at home while you were the U.S. attorney.
Unprecedented. It had never happened.
Okay. How long after that contact with Senator Domenici were you fired?
Approximately 6 weeks later, five weeks later.
Thereabouts. Thank you. Now let's go on to the call with Heather Wilson. Did the call with Congresswoman Wilson occur before or after your conversation with Senator Domenici?
The call from Congresswoman Wilson was approximately 2 weeks prior to the call from Senator Domenici.
You remember the day or date of that one?
It was on or about the 16th of October.
Got it. And please describe for the committee as best you can your entire recollection of that communication. Tell us what Congresswoman Wilson said and what you said.
That was also a very brief conversation. She mentioned, I mentioned I was just coming into Washington, D.C., and she joked, well, I'm sorry to hear that. She then asked me about, she'd been hearing about sealed indictments. And she said, what can you tell me about sealed indictments? The second she said any question about sealed indictments, red flags went up in my head because, as you know, we cannot talk about indictments until they're made public. In general, we specifically cannot talk about a sealed indictment. It's like calling up a scientist at Sandia Laboratories and asking them to, let's talk about those secret codes, those launch codes. So I was evasive and non-responsive to her questions. I said, well, we sometimes do sealed indictments for national security cases. Sometimes we have to do them for juvenile cases. And she was not happy with that answer. And then she said, well, I guess I'll have to take your word for it. And I said, I don't think I responded. Goodbye. And that was the substance of that conversation.
Did you feel pressured during that call?
Yes, sir, I did.
Okay. Did you feel as sick as you did after the second call?
Not as sick, because I didn't think there'd be any more communications.
Gotcha. That was former U.S. Attorney David Iglesias testifying last week before the Senate Judiciary Committee. He was questioned by Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer. The political journalist Joe Connison joins me now in our Firehouse studio, national correspondent for the New York Observer, columnist for Salon.com. He's also director of the investigative unit at the Nation Institute. He's been following the story closely and has a new book, which is called It Can Happen Here, Authoritarian Peril in the Age of Bush. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good to be with you, Amy.
It's good to have you here, Joe. Talk about the significance of this case, the whole U.S. attorney series of firings.
Well, the way these firings were handled and the apparent purpose of them, which is partisan and political so far as we can tell, is really a violation of traditional protections of federal law enforcement from partisan control. My view is that partisan control of these functions, partisan control of the prosecutorial process, is the sign of life in a banana republic, as you might say. A type of government that we've been trying to escape in this country for hundreds of years, where the sovereign, the executive, misuses or can misuse prosecutorial action against political enemies. These eight attorneys, in different ways, appear to have been had their loyalty questioned to the president, which, by the way, is not where their loyalty is supposed to go anyway. Their loyalty is to the Constitution, because either they were pursuing Republicans or not pursuing Democrats, as the president wished. This is why the involvement in this matter of the president's political advisor, Karl Rove, is of such great interest to Congress now. They want to understand why the White House counsel, Harriet Myers, and Karl Rove got so involved in apparently helping to choose which U.S. attorneys, who were very, very powerful officials in the justice system, would be removed.
Now, first they were going to fire all of them, right? All the U.S. attorneys.
Well, they said they were going to.
They claim,
yes.
And then whittled it down to eight.
Well, firing all of them, I guess, would have had the benefit of making it more confusing as to the reason why. But somebody in the system decided that would be much too disruptive to the entire justice system to fire them all in the middle of the president's term. So,
explain what U.S. attorneys do. Why are they so significant?
U.S. attorneys make the decisions about who to prosecute in federal criminal cases every day. They are the front line. There are cases that get bumped up to what's called main justice in Washington, where various assistants to the attorney general help to make these decisions. For instance, tradition was for a long time that if you were going to prosecute a journalist for refusing to testify, that was a decision that had to be made by the attorney general. But usual cases, drug cases, immigration cases, corruption cases, federal bank robbery cases, all those kinds of cases are handled by the U.S. attorney on the federal district level in each state, and they have a tremendous amount of power, which is supposed to be exercised independently. They're confirmed by the Senate, and they do serve at the pleasure of the president, but there are supposed to be checks and balances that ensure their independence.
We're talking to Joe Connison. He's director of the investigative unit at the Nation Institute and author of a new book, It Can Happen Here. We'll be back with him in a minute.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those Nazis. Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the feel that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Democracy, Leonard Cohen, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR, Low Power FM, college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations and both TV satellite networks. On Dish Network, Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available there in Spanish in audio and transcript form. As we continue our discussion on the purging of eight U.S. attorneys, let's turn to Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. He spoke about the scandal Tuesday.
I believe in the independence of our U.S. attorneys. They are the face of the department. They are my representative in the community. I acknowledge their sacrifice. I acknowledge their courage to step into the arena on behalf of the American people. Secondly, the Attorney General, all political appointees, such as U.S. attorneys, serve at the pleasure of the President of the United States. Third, I believe fundamentally in the constitutional role of the Senate in advice and consent with respect to U.S. attorneys, and would in no way support an effort to circumvent that constitutional role. I believe in accountability. Like every CEO of a major organization, I am responsible for what happens at the Department of Justice. I acknowledge that mistakes were made here. I accept that responsibility. And my pledge to the American people is to find out what went wrong here, to assess accountability, and to make improvements so that the mistakes that occurred in this instance do not occur again in the future. Finally, let me just say one thing. I've overcome a lot of obstacles in my life to become Attorney General. I am here not because I give up. I am here because I've learned from my mistakes, because I accept responsibility, and because I'm committed to doing my job. And that is what I intend to do here on behalf of the American people.
Minutes after Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez spoke to reporters, Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer responded from the floor of the Senate.
His time in office should be over. The U.S. attorney scandal, all the other instances where the Attorney General did not protect the rule of law are just too great a weight for the office to bear. To simply say I'm responsible and not tell people what it's all about makes no sense. You know, we just saw Scooter Libby be convicted, and many said he was a fall guy. We're not going to have another Scooter Libby, another fall guy. Kyle Sampson did many wrong things, and it's very possible he broke the criminal law. But, as Harry Truman said, the buck stops at the top. The buck stops with the Attorney General, and it defies belief that his chief of staff was making all these major decisions without his knowledge, particularly when it is clear that at least on a few instances, he admits he had phone calls from the president and from others about this issue.
New York Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer. Joe Connison, our guest, he's author of It Can Happen Here, Authoritarian Peril in the Age of Bush. Do you think Alberto Gonzalez going to be forced out?
Well, to be blunt, I think he should be. I wrote that in Salon the other day. I don't know if he'll be forced out. It seems as if right now the White House is kind of circling around him and protecting him. And I think there's going to be a big confrontation, really, between the White House and the Congress, not only over the fate of Gonzalez, who's now claiming that he's going to investigate himself, essentially, for what he did, but whether Rove and Myers have to testify. There will be a fight over executive powers as to whether these two are forced to testify about exactly how all of this went down.
Talk about Nevada and the what happened.
Well, the U.S. attorney in Northern Nevada, his name is Daniel Bogden, was one of the eight U.S. attorneys who was fired in December, or seven were fired in December. And John Ensign, who's the Republican senator, junior senator from Nevada, who almost never says anything, particularly anything against Bush, and who was chosen to be the next head of the National Republican Senatorial Committee, which is their reelection committee, has been screaming about this. Why? Because he feels that he was lied to, essentially, by the Attorney General and the Justice Department over the reasons for the firing of Bogden. He was told that this was for performance-related reasons, and then it came out this was not about performance because this Attorney General's performance was very good. I mean, the evaluations all showed that actually all of the seven
and the aide testified in the Senate saying it was not over an issue of performance.
It was not. There's no evidence that there was any lack of performance on their part at all. And in fact, you could say that Carol Lamb, the U.S. attorney for San Diego, who was fired by indicting and uncovering this enormous bribery scheme of Duke Cunningham, did one of the best jobs of any attorney general in recent U.S. attorney in recent years. The fact that they would fire somebody who had done that really tells you where this was going.
Put Randy Duke Cunningham behind bars.
Put him behind bars and continue to explore this rather large criminal conspiracy that he was at the center of, which includes other members of Congress, potentially other government officials.
You write about Alberto Gonzalez in your book, It Can Happen Here, Authoritarian Peril in the Age of Bush. Fit Gonzalez into the picture that you have drawn of this country.
Well, again, you know, the Attorney General, for the same reasons that you want independent U.S. attorneys, the Attorney General is supposed to have a measure of independence from the White House. This is why people were raised questions when Robert Kennedy was appointed Attorney General by his brother years ago. Alberto Gonzalez is not regarded as a figure of independence and probity. He is a yes man for George W. Bush, and he always has been. And the fear, he was when he was White House counsel. And the other problem that I think the Congress now increasingly has with him is they don't feel he's truthful with them. They don't feel that he respects the separation of powers. They feel that he represents the idea of the unitary executive, which is to say an executive branch that has aggrandized power to itself and doesn't feel accountable to the other branches.
The Democrats have vowed to repeal a portion of the Patriot Act that says that the provision allows the U.S. Attorney General to replace prosecutors without Senate confirmation.
Right. Well, that was, again, a piece of legislation that was apparently sneaked into the Patriot Act by somebody acting on behalf of the White House to reduce the powers of the Senate, although it was done under the name of a senator, Arlen Specter, who then said he didn't know that this had happened. This was a stunning development, and this is one of the reasons why the senators are finally starting to realize what the implications are of this White House philosophy of aggrandized power. It is turning them into a rubber stamp.
Now, Alberto Gonzalez told the Senate that the president would not intervene if Congress passed a reversal of the firings.
Well, yes, I think they feel in a somewhat weakened state right now. But, of course, Gonzalez promised long ago that they would never appoint U.S. attorneys that weren't confirmed by the Senate. That turned out not to be true. He told them that he would inform them if there was warrantless wiretapping. When he was first confirmed, Senator Feingold asked him, you know, would you inform us in a timely way if you ever decided to use these kinds of powers? And Gonzalez said, yes, sir. And he was lying at the moment he said that. So, because he knew that they had already undertaken that program. So there's a reason why the Senate is, at this point, more than skeptical of Alberto Gonzalez, and some of them are ready to say he's got to go.
The testimony of Iglesias was very chilling, the U.S. attorney from New Mexico who was fired. He talked about the two politicians intervening, the hotly contested seat of Heather Wilson, that she did, he said, the Republican congressmember, and Senator Pete Domenici, who, as you said, has now lawyered up.
Yes.
Talk about his lawyer, Blalick.
Well, Blalick happens, of all things, to have been one of the criminal attorneys for Duke Cunningham, which I thought was a bad choice from what in Washington they call the optics of the situation. You don't really want people looking at it that way. It's a little too close to home. I believe that Heather Wilson, I'm pretty sure she has also gotten herself defense counsel. I think they're worried, you know, at worst, this could be seen as an attempt to obstruct justice on their part. I'm not saying they're going to be indicted or that they did that crime, but clearly they felt the need for defense counsel. I think there will be ethics investigations of both of them and also of Doc Hastings in Washington State, who participated in a similar attempt to pull the rug out from under a U.S. attorney. I mean, these are extremely serious charges.
It can happen here.
Yes.
Why did you choose that title?
That's the title. Well, there was a book in 1935 written by Sinclair Lewis called It Can't Happen Here, which was kind of a satirical novel about the rise of fascism in the United States, which doesn't sound like a very funny subject, but he managed to bring some humor to a very grim subject, which was our descent into an authoritarian state after the 1936 election. Sinclair Lewis was married at the time to a foreign correspondent named Dorothy Thompson, who was one of the greatest of her time and maybe of all time, who had been kicked out of Nazi Germany in 1934 and had come home for telling the truth about Hitler and had come home and basically spent a lot of time telling her husband that the world was on the verge of potential fascist takeover and he ought to try to do something about it. And this is why he wrote this novel. I read that book, and it occurred at the urging of my editor at St. Martin's Press, and it occurred to me that there were many striking parallels, actually, between what Sinclair Lewis had imagined as the kind of authoritarianism that could come to America and some of the things that we've been seeing in the last several years here.
You make some stark parallels between what's happening now and the Nixon administration when it came to trying to obliterate the checks and balances.
Right.
Explain.
Well, In his own clumsy way, Nixon was drawing all power into the White House, felt no accountability to Congress, felt that he could violate the law. You know, he told David Frost after he was forced from office that if the president does it, it's not against the law, which is false. And it was the statement that ended his presidency, really, that attitude. But there were people who came to power under George W. Bush, principally the vice president, Dick Cheney, who were veterans of the Nixon administration, who felt that Nixon actually was the victim and who agreed with him that in times of emergency, which they regarded the protests against the Vietnam War as being part of an emergency, in times of war, and they now see us involved in a war that has no end, that presidential power is absolute. Presidential power brooks no opposition or check from the legislative or judicial branches. And Cheney believes in that very strongly.
Cheney and secrecy right through to the federal directory.
That's right. Well, Cheney, that's the vice president, does not tell the federal directory or anybody else who works in his office or what their jobs are as a matter of policy, which is stunning indeed.
Can you talk about going back to D.C. 9/11, that movie about President Bush? Why does that fit in here? It's like a docudrama. Who cares?
Well, you know, because it portrayed it in an almost Soviet style. You know, Jim Hoberman, who's the Village Voice film reviewer, compared it to the old Soviet movies about Stalin, in which Stalin was the infallible hero, and you know, was leading the country against the enemy. And it really kind of falsified what had happened on 9/11, in fact, with Bush sort of running around the country and not knowing what to do or what to say. none of us were supposed to pay attention to that at the time. And this film was made in order to create a false image of Bush as this infallible leader, the beloved leader type of thing, which is not what we do in democratic countries. It's not that's that type of propaganda is, which was made, by the way, in full cooperation with the White House and Republicans in Hollywood, is just, it's a type of thing that that you see in countries that don't have very good democratic
and
traditions.
And Fox's role in this? I mean, now, well, Fox occupies the podium at the
Fox,
White House with
you
the
know,
in, press
in,
spokesperson.
In Sinclair Lewis's book, all of the press was taken over, basically, by the government and expropriated, except for the Hearst Corporation's newspapers and radio stations, which served the dictatorship very abjectly and basically did whatever the new president, Buzz Windrip, said. I draw some connection between that type of behavior and Fox's behavior as a propaganda outlet for the White House in ways that I don't think we've seen before in this country.
The rise of the religious right, and particularly Ralph Reed.
Well, you know, Ralph Reed served as he was a new type of operative who made a connection between the traditional religious right, which was kind of at the grassroots in the churches, and the corporate lobbying world in Washington, which was a very a critical alliance in the Republican Party, because what it did was combine money and propaganda power that existed in Washington with troops on the ground at election time. And this is the modern Republican Party in many ways.
We're talking to Joe Connison. He's author of It Can Happen Here. I want to end with the NSA letters and what they mean. Gonzalez is embroiled in the U.S. attorney firing scandal. Now it's become clear the FBI did not reveal the number of NSA letters that it gave out, particularly talking about the secret databases, the cooperation of telecommunications companies.
Right.
Explain what an NSA letter is. Why is this significant? Who's getting spied
on? National security letter is essentially it allows the government to violate your constitutional rights without getting any warrant. I mean, this is it substitutes for a normal warrant in allowing them to go into your home, go into your communications, on the theory that you are some kind of a threat to the security of the United States. And when I say you, the problem is it could in theory be anyone. It's supposed to be a terrorist or somebody who's connected with terrorism, but that definition is left very much in the dark because there is no check and balance on it. And that's one of the problems that people have seen with now. They have admitted, after an inspector general's report looked into who was getting these letters and what they were being used for, that there had been abuses of it. And the FBI director, I thought very forthrightly, admitted the other day that not only were there abuses, but there wasn't a system set up to make sure that abuses could be prevented. And this is exactly what people feared in the wake of the Patriot Act, that this kind of non-system would lead to, grave abuses of people's privacy and liberty.
You talk about the role of the media in increasing, consolidating the power of the state. What about in fighting the rise of a fascist state?
Well, the only way that, and I don't think we're anywhere close to a fascist state. Now, what we have is a group of people in government who have authoritarian impulses that they pursue and that they would like to pursue. And the only check against that is an informed citizenry, Amy, as you know. I mean, you help to do it every day. This is how people can oppose this, is only if they know what's going on. And the mainstream media does a mediocre job of informing them every day, I'm afraid.
We'll end this conversation with the quote you begin with, Sinclair Lewis's quote, "When fascism comes to America, it will be wrapped in the flag carrying a cross." Where do you see us in the spectrum?
Well, right now, I actually feel hopeful because, after all, you and I can sit here and talk about them and say whatever we want. And we did have an election last fall in which the opposition won a fairly pretty substantial victory, at least in the House. And now there are members of the House who have decided that they're going to try to roll back some of these abuses. Gerald Nadler, who's now the chairman of the Constitution Subcommittee of the House Judiciary Committee was with me in New York the other night and put out a long list of things that they intend to do to start to question and to change some of these abuses that we've seen in the last several years. Chris Dodd and Senator Pat Leahy from the Judiciary Committee have already put in a bill to restore the rights of habeas corpus, which is one of the sort of grossest things that the administration did in passing the Military Commissions Act last year. So I think you're going to see some pushback.
Joe Connison, thank you very much for joining us. It can happen. Here is the title of his book, Authoritarian Peril in the Age of Bush. When we come back, Italian journalist Giuliana Screna. She was captured by the Iraqi resistance, abducted for a month. When she was released and headed back to Baghdad airport, she was fired on by U.S. troops. The Italian agent who rescued her was killed in the shooting. Stay with us. The people of Baghdad, Inam Wali, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Italy's criticized the Bush administration for failing to claim responsibility for the 2005 killing of Italian intelligence agency Niccolò Calipari in Iraq. Speaking at a commemoration for Calipari on March 4th, Italian Foreign Minister Massimo D'Alema openly challenged the United States and said, quote, right now, there is a need for justice to be done. Calipari, the number two man in the Italian military intelligence, died while escorting Italian reporter Giuliana Screna out of Iraq after securing her release from a month-long abduction. U.S. forces opened fire on their vehicle as they drove to Baghdad International Airport. Another agent and Screna were wounded in the attack. Last month, a judge in Rome ordered New York Army National Guard soldier Mario Lozano to stand trial in Italy on murder charges. But Washington's refused to hand him over considers the case closed. Lozano will be tried next month in absentia. Giuliana Screna wrote about her experience in her book Friendly Fire, the remarkable story of a journalist kidnapped in Iraq. She is a veteran foreign correspondent for the Italian newspaper Il Manifesto, has reported frequently from Afghanistan, Iraq, Israel, Palestine, Lebanon. She joins us now in a Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
I look forward to seeing you tonight, by the way, at the Judson Church here in New York. Yes. At 7 o'clock, having a conversation. Let's start with this trial in absentia of Mario Lozano, yes, who is based here in New York, the Army National Guardsman. How do you know he is the shooter?
From the report of the U.S. Military Commission. In the U.S. Military Commission that did an inquiry in Iraq after the abduction. So they said that Mario Lozano was the man in charge for the shooting inside the patrol that shot to us. So it is the one that...
Was there only one shooter?
They say that is the only one, but some experts, my experts and one of the wife of Calipari, found that maybe there was another man shooting, because they found in the car where we were traveling to the airport one piece of bullet that was not the same as the others. So different screening and so.
For listeners and viewers who aren't familiar with your case, explain exactly what happened. The date was March 5th?
4th.
March 4th. Exactly a month to the day that you were abducted, February 4th.
Yes, exactly, yes.
The Italian intelligence agency, Calipari, is that how you pronounce it, Calipari?
Yes.
Comes to work on your release.
Yeah.
He secures it. You're in the car together. You two are in the back seat, and the driver's in the front seat.
No, nobody was in the... when we left from the place where I was released, yes, Calipari was beside me, and the driver, that was another agent of the Italian intelligence, it was driving. It was in front.
How fast are you going? Did you feel that you were in danger? You were on a dangerous road, is that right, to Baghdad International
Airport?
Yes,
of course, and we wanted to arrive to the airport, but anyway, in the moment in which the car went more fast, it was going at 65 kilometers per hour. This is the result of the inquiry of the verified did the Italian expert named by the judges to verify the speed of the car, because they could calculate through the bullet, the sequence, and through other things how the speed of the car.
Now, the U.S. military says that your car was signaled to slow down, that warning shots were fired, but that they were ignored.
No, we have not seen any warning, because the patrol was not on the street. The patrol was outside the street, behind the curb, and we have not seen any warnings, because if not, we could be stopped. There was no problem. But we have seen no warnings, and when the light arrived to us, immediately with the light, with the light arrived the bullets.
And Niccolò Calipari lay down on top of you, or fell on top of you after he was shot?
No, he pushed me down between the two seats, and to protect me was under, it was up to me.
On top of you?
Yes. And then they continued to shoot. And
how many shots fired?
Against the car, they found 58 bullets, and 57 were against the passengers of the car. Only one, the last one, was against the engine of the car. That's why the Italian judges, they will put in trial Lozano for voluntarily killing, because if he wanted to stop the car, he has to shoot to the engines before, or to the wheels of the car, and not all the majority, the great majority of the bullets against the passengers.
You speak English. When the car stopped, when the agent was dead, Calipari, you two were injured, the driver and you. Mm-hmm. What were the soldiers saying? Did they know who you were? Did you warn in advance that you were coming on this road?
I think that they knew. I am not sure if this patrol knew, because because all the communication between the patrol and the commander were destroyed just after what happened.
And so repeat that.
Yes, all the communication between the patrol and the division commander were destroyed, because when the two Italians that took part of the military commission, they went to Baghdad and they asked for the communication, because there was some differences between the testifying of the different soldiers in the patrol. But they said...
How could the documents be destroyed? I mean, this is an extremely high-level case. You have Calipari, who was personally close to the Italian prime minister at the time, Berlusconi, who was a close Bush ally. There was a massive celebration prepared for your return to Italy. How could these documents have been destroyed?
Yes, that is one of the points that we can't understand why they destroyed, because there was something to hidden to counsel, because if not, why they destroyed all the communication just after the shooting and after the killing of Calipari. This is very strange, isn't it?
So what would you like to see happen right now?
I wanted to know what happened that night in Baghdad. So I would like to have some people testifying what happened. I know that is very difficult, because if there is no cooperation of the United States authorities, it's very difficult to know what happened. But maybe there is some people that have news about that, and some news we had during this period, because there was, for example, one that was before an agent of the National Security of United States that said that they knew what happened in Baghdad, who were in the car, because they always control, or they are always controlling all the communication between satellite telephones and cell telephones, and so, because they are in a situation of war, so in war they used to control all the communication. Because, of course, there can be some communication interesting for the occupying forces. So they knew, and I think that they knew, because why to destroy all the communication if there is nothing to hidden?
I want to ask you quickly about another kidnapping, the kidnapping of the Italian journalist Danielle Mastrogiacomo. In Afghanistan right now.
Yes.
What is the situation?
The situation is that he was kidnapped by the military structure of Taliban. And
how long has he been held?
10 days. It was Sunday before.
Do you know him?
Yes, I know him, because we were together in Iraq. And he's a friend. He's not only a colleague, he's a friend. And now they say, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs said there is a communication with the kidnappers through a humanitarian...
Gino Strada emergency?
I think that probably because...
The doctor who sets up emergency rooms in conflict zones.
Because they have an hospital in Lashkargar, that is the capital of Helmand, that is the province where Daniele was kidnapped. So for them, it's easy to be in touch with the people of this area. So it's the most probably thing that will be emergency, the connection.
What do you... You've been covering Afghanistan. You've been to Afghanistan. What is the most significant thing to understand about what is happening in Afghanistan today?
I think that is to understand that there is no peace, no democracy in Afghanistan now, because when I started the war in Iraq, Afghanistan was presented as a model to follow. There was working, and so we can follow this model. But the model was not a good model, because in the south we have still Taliban, or not only Taliban, because now we call Taliban all the people that are against the government of Karzai. But they are very hostile to the occupation forces, because the majority of the attacks are in the south of the country. And in the north, and in Kabul, in power are still the people, the jihadists that did the war before against the Soviet Union when it was occupying Afghanistan, and then after the withdrawal of the Soviet forces, they started to fight each other, and they destroyed Kabul. And these people that are military people with militias, armed, so they are controlling the north of Iraq, piece by piece. And they have also the control with the Taliban of the drugs traffic. So they have a lot of money, and the people, they have no money at all, and all the economy, half of the economy of Afghanistan is based on the drug traffic, the opium traffic.
Juliana Scadena, tell us about this mass protest in Italy on February 19th. Over 100,000 people took to the streets of Vicenza, protesting the plan to double the size of the U.S. military base. Over 2,700 U.S. forces are already based there. Critics of the plan say the plan will be used as a staging post for the U.S. military to attack Iraq and Afghanistan. I think it was February 17th where the protest took
place. Yes, there was a big protest. It was not only of the anti-war movement, but this time, along with the anti-war movement, there was also a lot of people living there in Vicenza, because the base that we have now is already a very big base that is entering in the town. So it's not out of the town, it's in the town. And the town is a very historical place with a lot of monuments of Palladio and so. So if they double the base, it will be something unacceptable for the people. And overall, in some cases, you know, when there is a military base, they say we will have some business and so, but it's not the case of Vicenza, because the U.S. military, they bring all what they need from outside, even the Coca-Cola and so. So people, and there is a lot of pollution because of the flights of the plane that do a lot of exercise, so there is a lot of pollution. But for the anti-war movement, is a question of principle, because if we withdraw the troops from Iraq, we can't offer the platform to the United States to strike Iraq. It's a contradiction. So for the anti-war movement, it's a very important question, the one of Vicenza, because it's really situated in a place from where you can live to go and strike Middle East, all Middle East, in particular Iraq and Afghanistan.
I wanted to ask you about another case where Italian prosecutors are asking for extradition of more than two dozen Italian agents, U.S. CIA agents, involved with the kidnapping of Abu Omar off the streets of Milan. He says he was taken to Egypt. He was tortured there. He has just come out and spoken about his experience.
Yes.
How common? How much is there an awareness of this in Italy? And talk about this case.
About this case, there are a lot of people in, that they know this story, because it was a story that was important also for the development of the Italian intelligence service, because we discovered that some agents were linked to the USA intelligence, and others they were not. So there was a lot of discussion inside Italy about these cases of Abu Omar.
And the head of Italian intelligence was forced to step down around this.
Yes, yes, yes.
We're going to have to leave it there, but we will continue this discussion tonight in New York at Judson Church at 7 o'clock, and I look forward to speaking with you there. We also have a TV producer position open here at Democracy Now! You can go to our website, democracynow.org, send your resume to job@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shrufa Bodokadus, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich and Aramate, John Yutz, Anuradha Bhagwati, Megan Whitney, Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio, Miguel Nogueira, our engineers. Special thanks to Angela Alston, as well as Andrew Quinn. Our website, again, is democracynow.org. You can get video and audio podcasts and transcripts of the broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.